Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to After the Jump. I'm Grace Bonney, and for the next half hour, we're going to be exploring the world of art, design, and all of the issues and ideas currently kicking around the creative community. We are recording live today from Roberta's, and every Monday afternoon at 12 p.m. You can listen online at theheritageradionetwork.org, and you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen to the archives at heritageradionetwork.org as well. Today, I'm incredibly honored to be sitting next to none other than designer and maker extraordinaire, Todd Oldham. Todd is a personal hero of mine and is a true Renaissance man in his ability to constantly tackle so many areas of art and design with not only great skill but respect for the craft behind them. So it's an honor to have you here today, Todd.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be with you on your inaugural show too.
I can't think of a better person to start with, not only just because of your history with the creative community, but how involved you still are today. And we were just speaking about your soon to be 20th book. And
Yes.
How passionate you are about that. So I want to start, though, a little bit earlier. I want to go back to the beginnings, primarily because you're from Texas.
Dinosaur days?
We're heading back to Corpus Christi. So you're originally from Texas, and yeah. I'm always really fascinated by the way that someone, where they're from, how it shapes their personal style. And as a fellow Southerner, I'd love to know how being from Texas and your background there really shaped your personal style, at least in those early years.
Well, Texas is a very unique place, and I was actually born there and then moved on very quickly and returned in my teens for a brief time. But it's a very odd place, and it's a great place to be from and a great place to leave, frankly. But it's just a different situation now than it was when I got to kind of play around there. But it's a super eccentric place. It's where you see people in, you used to see people like 20 karat diamond rings and overalls. And you just, it was truly like this whole other way of being where you just, some things didn't matter and other things did, but it was not the normal one. So I was always intrigued the way it kind of was, this subculture that sort of rose from the ground like a mushroom of sorts. You know, didn't seem like it was planned, but it was really unique.
How big of a role was making things and sort of creativity in your life at that age? I mean, did you come from a family where they were encouraging you to sort of build things with your own two hands?
Yes, indeed. I've been very lucky. My parents are very gifted artists on their own right and very skilled. So they spent most of their time teaching us how to do stuff. We're four children, so we always joke that they made a workforce, not children. And they used us, too. We built on additions to our house, and I'm forever grateful for knowing how to wire lamps. I'm the one that people ask, can you put in the dimmer switch when you come over? And that's a good skill. I'm happy to be able to do it.
So what inspired you to first leave Texas, other than Texas?
Texas was the best motivation for leaving Texas for me. It's a great place. It just was for the things I was interested in. It no longer was supportive of what I was doing. But for being a little freaky kid, it was a lot of fun.
That's great. I mean, I think that there, for me, there's always sort of an essentially Southern quality to a lot of the crafts that you do. And I don't know if that's shaped from where you're from or just the way that I grew up. But I feel like a lot of those sort of around the house craft skills that I don't seem to find in other people's backgrounds from the West Coast as much as I do people from the South. I think that's sort of always in your work. And I love that about it so much.
Thank you. There's a scrappiness to what we do. And I think to a lot of Southern points of view. But I had the great benefit of living all over the world. I mean, I lived even in Iran from age 12 to 16, which is pretty formidable time and very fruitful in shaping my ideas. But we lived all over America. We travel constantly. So I have much more of a world point of view, I think, than a Southern point of view.
So how long have you been in New York now?
I moved here full time in 1989.
And how has New York shaped your style?
Well, it hasn't killed me yet, so that's always a good start. I truly love New York, and you have no choice. You know, if you do the things that we get to do, the privilege of being able to do what we get to do, you really should need to be here to make that happen. But I remember very fondly New York in the 80s when it was Halloween every day in the East Village and where I lived, and it was nothing was more fun than that time period, I think.
I think one of the things I love, your work, while it has that Southern quality I love, it also feels very New York-y to me. And I think some of that is because of the interesting collaborations that you've done. What role does collaboration play in the work that you do? I love seeing, you know, people like Amy Sedaris pop up all the time, but what role do those collaborations play in terms of like pushing forward new work?
Well, I'm always thrilled to get to collaborate because I'm endlessly fascinated at other people's efforts, foibles, whatever you want to call it, talents. It's just all very, very interesting to me. It's like a giant soap opera I can't avert my eyes from. So I don't ever worry about, I mean, I'm very secure in what I get to do. So there's, ego doesn't play much of a part of these things. And I generally tend to work with people that share that thought. So it's really just about having the most fun and trying to do something fresh and interesting. And I'm process oriented. So if I'm not enjoying it while I'm doing it, then it really doesn't exist for me. The minute it's done, it's gone. And I have no control and basically no interest, frankly.
We were talking before the show about process, and particularly the process that relates to books, and that you now have more books than I can even fathom writing at this point under your belt. And I'd love to talk about how those projects began. You've done so many, especially the monographs, that are completely focused on a single artist, whether it's Charlie Harper or Alexander Girard or the work of John Waters. And how do those projects come about, and what sort of draws you to those individuals?
Well, those people are, one might look at it and think of it as a disparate group of artists, but to me, there's a great thread running through them all, and that's that they're absolutely singular and have nothing to prove other than just the passion of doing what they do. The side effect of that is that they're brilliant and do fantastically mind-blowingly things. But what I appreciate is this urge, or the artist Wayne White, who I did a giant monograph on, and that man's possessed. I mean, he would come stay with me for time periods in the country, and where we would all go to bed, he would basically just start. And I'd wake up the next morning, there would be piles of these drawings that were exquisite. But it's one of the few times I've ever been in proximity to someone that had no choice to create. Like he would have died. I'm pretty sure Wayne would die if he didn't have that in his life every day. So that's a really interesting situation to pull a chair up to, you know?
And I mean, I know you spent years doing the Girard collection. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like?
Yeah, that book came out in December, and it's the biggest book I've done. It's 672 pages, and it was 1,100 pages in January before it got its final edit. But Mr. Girard is an astonishing artist, and he's one of those rare treasures in the world, because everything is pretty well, I don't know, exploited or understood. You know, most of design heroes, we know way too much about them at this point. But Mr. Girard was kind of this amazing secret. He was dear friends with Charles and Ray Eames and George Nelson and Eros Saarinen and all these people that we know as the masters of this mid-century aesthetic. But he didn't do too many things that were available at retail, and he was constantly in support of others. So he had a volume of work that matched theirs. Certainly, I imagine it exceeded it. Even the Eames, which were prolific, highly prolific people, but no one had really seen it. So we got to travel all over the world. The Girard archive was deacquisitioned to Vitra in Basel, Switzerland. So we went through, you know, mountains of stuff there, and went all through Herman Miller's archive and through Santa Fe and wherever we could collect it to pull it together. But there's 2,300 images in the book.
Gosh.
We had over 30,000 documents by the time that we had finally got it all in one place.
And how many people did you work with on that book?
Well, not as many as you'd think. There was the main editing was done by, it was me. And the writing was thankfully done by Kira Coffey. It became where, as our deadline approached, I could not handle the writing any longer because it was just the volume of it was too big. So I was very blessed to get Kira Coffey in, who's, I think, a genius. And we had worked together on a magazine called Nest that I think is one of the most important design documents ever.
Absolutely. I definitely want to talk about more of your magazine work at some point. Mm-hmm. I think your contributions to Ready Made are still things that I have tacked up on
walls
and places. But I want to talk about the book just a little bit more for people who aren't familiar with how grueling the book process is, especially for a book that large. It's unimaginable how much work, and it really is a passion project. And I think you share that in quality with the people that you've written about before. I mean, you have to be consumed by whatever that subject matter is to really do it well.
You really do, and it takes the most selfless passion one can muster, and also responsibility. It's very different when I'm doing a book of my own ideas or, you know, anything that I instigate. But when you have you know, especially in the case of Mr. Gerard and Charlie Harper, I had 60 plus years of these men's work at my hands, and the last thing you want to do is screw that up. So I take those things highly, highly responsibly and make sure that I mirror back the artist Rosetta Stone and their work in the most beautiful, graceful way.
Do you work with their families in any way to sort of run things by them, or is that on your own?
No, I definitely make sure I want to make everyone pleased that is connected with it, because there'd be nothing sadder than, you know, if you had upset a family member or any part of the legacy. So while I know that it is uncommon, and I do have creative control over it, I always make sure that with all of my subjects, I keep them as involved as possible. But the Gerard book was odd because Mr. Gerard isn't with us any longer. He passed in the 90s, and everyone else I've worked with has been around, so I could ask a question of, or what is this? You know, basically, you can't believe not being able to ask, what is this? How much more work that is.
Yeah, I mean, bringing up books in general reminds me of a topic that I think is really important to, I mean, all designers, but particularly the community that I'm working in right now. I think the idea of work-life balance is really difficult, and we don't think any of us have any idea.
Yeah,
what is it? How do you do it? I wonder, does that exist in your world? I mean, the amount of work you produce on a yearly basis is mind-boggling. Do you have a place in your life for non-work?
Well, not so much lately. I have a great family and support system. I've been with my boyfriend for over 30 years, and he's very patient and understanding of the colossal messes I make in my wake everywhere I go. But you trade time differently, you know. This is my way of being in service, and I don't just mean to be in service to the designer, but I know these people I get to write about or corral their work are made a difference to me. And I think that there will make a difference in the world. And that's why I'm really happy to be able to be a part of shining a flashlight on something so very meaningful. But I never think that this is about, any of those things are about me. They're mm-hmm. absolutely about the designer. And we go crazy making sure that we have invisible design as far as our studio goes.
I think that's great. But when it does come down to you, what are the ways that you unwind, relax, sort of unplug from how intensely you work?
I read a lot, and I love to read, so that I can be transported very instantly. So just to crack a book at any point. I also like to reread books. So when the first read is for the initial impact, and then I start analyzing. I love to dig in and find out why things are moving me in certain ways. So you start, you know, the second read will start revealing different tricks, and by the third, I'm like Margaret Mead being an analyst and archivist trying to figure out what's going on here.
And I'm dying to know, since you do produce so much work, what do you do when and if you hit creative blocks? Do you even hit creative blocks? I feel like I can't imagine you hitting one because you're always producing something, but
I don't. Creative blocks, I've thankfully, it's been never an issue for me. I'm way too interested in, well, everything, frankly, to let it fall apart like that. I get fatigued sometimes. If I deal with too many assholes, that can be a little fatiguing, I find. But if I keep my asshole ratio a little bit lower, then I'm smooth sailing pretty much.
That sounds pretty good. Do you have a team around you that helps you manage the asshole ratio?
Yes, we have asshole wranglers on staff, and they do an excellent job. But it's just a matter of creating a team, a sort of pack mentality of people mm-hmm. that believe as you do, because it's not normal thought process. It's a bit thankless in a way, which is not, you know, that's no problem. It's just an observation. And to sign up for the magnitude of this work, it takes a certain level of crazy.
And how did you go about building that team? I think that's something that a lot of younger artists are curious in knowing, because you want to have complete control over everything with your name on it, but it's impossible to do every single thing mm-hmm. by yourself. So how did you find those people that you've ended up trusting and working with?
Well, I have a very, very scant turnover. So that's the thing. It's mostly been people that have stuck with me for a long time. I'm very grateful for the amazing teams. But I like to work with young people and people fresh out of school, because they're not damaged yet. And I find anybody, if you've gone through a lot of the normal systems, like there's several companies, if they end up on somebody's resume, I immediately just go, not for me. Because they've already, I know all the bad tricks they've learned already. So I prefer to get people that are vibrant. I mean, we're kind of the island of misfit toys a little bit. So like-minded folks generally kind of are magnetized to one another.
That sounds great. Well, I think that sounds like a good place to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about your work with larger companies. I'm dying to know what it's like to work with big brands versus tiny brands.
Sure. Thank you.
This program is sponsored by Tri-State Merchant Services. If you are a business owner, then you are processing credit or debit cards and checks. Providers for these services can be large, faceless companies who take your business for granted. But at Tri-State Merchant Services, your satisfaction is our priority, and we strive to earn your business every day. We offer more than just credit card processing. We provide valuable insight, solutions, and practical tools for streamlining your business. What's more, while we have the manpower of the leading processors, we never lose sight of the fact that every business starts small and that together we can do big things. At Tri-State Merchant Services, we believe in working with local businesses to strengthen our community. A strong community builds a strong economy. Check out our partner referral program and all of our services at tmsmerchant.com.
Hey, and welcome back to After the Jump. I'm Grace Bonney, and today I'm speaking with designer and all-around crafty man extraordinaire, Todd Oldham. And we are recording live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and we're here every Monday from 12 to 12:30. You can listen online at heritageradionetwork.org, and you can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or listen to the archives at heritageradionetwork.org. So before the break, we were talking about sort of how you got to be where you are now, and I thought it was hilarious that in the ad that played in between these segments that they mentioned large faceless companies. And one of the things I've been dying to talk to you about is the work you've done with larger corporations, which I don't think are inherently evil things. And I'm always very interested to hear about people's experiences working with, you've worked with Target and Old Navy and Lazy Boy, among others. What's it like working with big companies like that versus how much you do on your own in-house?
Well, I kind of sign up for the same situation no matter what. But you need to, if you wish to share your ideas in a really, in a bigger, broadcast in a bigger way, so to speak, some, it takes partners if you don't have that system set up, which I don't. So to be able to work with somebody like Target, a very forward-leaning company, has always been a huge pleasure. Like, we're right in the middle of, we're about to launch May 20th, next month, the launch of this really fun project we're doing called Kid Made Modern. And it's 48 art supplies and crafts and kits and things, and I wanted to make it really accessible and affordable. So to partner with somebody, it had to be somebody like Target that had 1,700 stores that could get it in, and they've been super generous, and it's in all stores for a couple of years. So we're really, really excited. So that part's great, but I think the big company can be a big advantage or a huge detriment, and it has to do with usually the company and where they are in the landscape and how forward leaning they are. Mm-hmm. A company like Target is very, very forward leaning and constantly trying to shape shift and make people's lives better through, you know, just being better at the design, better at manufacturing, better at the prices, and they continue to do that, but all the while with conscionable manufacturing. So it's really a privilege to get to work with them. And some of the companies, I've made them, it's not worked out very well because they have not been forward-leaning, or the trouble with really big companies is they tend to attract, they can attract a Machiavellian element, and that's usually what leads to success in those kinds of companies. Mm-hmm. So if you don't share those Machiavellian, you know, interest, you can really get either chewed up and spit out or singed and heartbroken, which happened for sure. But so I just think that's just, it's not a company specific, it's anybody that's dragging their heels and stuck in the past, because mm-hmm. The world doesn't need you now, they're not going to forget you.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of need in the world, but it just has to be something forward. Anybody resting on laurels or doing old-fashioned ideas is just going to drown.
I think that's a great point to make. And it does seem like a double-edged sword. I have loved over the past 10 years watching larger companies like Target and tons of other companies working with smaller designers or independent designers to do these guest collections. But they seem to really come and go really quickly. And I love that. I think yours have sort of continued. But I still miss your Lazy Boy sofas, I have to say.
Oh, thank you. Well, that was fun.
The sofa was great.
Oh, thank you. Well, it was fun to work with a company that, I mean, I like them very much. I know that they can often be a punchline in a joke, and people think of them as, you know, with these big behemoth things with duct tape holding them together at some point because no one gets rid of them. That is interesting to me. You know, I'm not pretentious, and I don't really care about people think that something's too haughty or not haughty enough mm-hmm. or whatever. So I was happy to work with this giant American company.
I think that's one thing that I've always really loved about you as a designer, is that you don't seem to approach any products with, or projects with, that sort of preconceived notion of like, this is above me, this is below me, this is too, like, lazy, would Lazy Boy seem like it was too lowbrow? You really sort of approached it with fresh eyes, and you made me consider buying a Lazy Boy sofa, aww, which is not something I thought I would ever do. And I think Derek and Lauren Fagerstrom still have the Snap sofa in their apartment in San Francisco, and it's still a beautiful piece today. And I think it's great to see people approach companies that you maybe wouldn't expect to see them doing that. Are there any companies you'd like to work with, or that you think they could benefit from the Oldham experience?
Oh gosh, well, I would never say that someone could benefit from working with me, but
I could say that.
Well, you're very sweet too. I'm interested in all kinds of new ways, and what's the most interesting to me at this moment is the shifts in technology, and the fact that, well, just look at what we're doing today. We're basically having a radio show that has the roots in, you know, many, many, many decades ago, but now it's being delivered in a completely different way, and we're still honoring the great idea of storytelling and communication. And so I think that's fascinating, but in a completely new arena. So anything that's sort of got one toe of honor in the past and a giant foot stuck in the future of possibility, that to me is the perfect recipe these days.
Well, speaking of the past, I want to pay a quick clip of something that is the reason I am familiar with your work at all and continue to be a huge fan. And I'll see, uh-oh, if anybody remembers this from the opening bars.
Well, greetings from Paris. Bonjour. Well, you don't have to be French to be a designer in Paris. So let's have a look into the worlds of Andre Walker and John Galliano.
Let's talk a little bit about your current collection that you showed just a few days ago.
The name of this collection was called Someone I'm in Love With In, Nice Darling. She's a corny girl that wants to hang out. These clothes are for the corny girl, are for the stale girl who wants to be gross.
All right, we're going to stop there. For those of you who aren't familiar, that was a clip, an epic clip from Todd Time, which was your amazing segment on House of Style, which was a fantastic show that aired on MTV in the 90s. And you did incredible projects, as well as interviewing some really avant-garde and interesting and edgy designers that, you know, weren't being showcased on mainstream media and still, frankly, aren't really being broadcast anymore. What was the House of Style experience like for you?
Oh, that was one of the most fun things I ever got to do. It was a kind of one of those things when all the stars lined up perfectly, and I got to be on the very first show, and it was right when I was starting to design fashion and had a beautiful kind of explosion. And Cindy Crawford, who was the host of House of Style, also, I had the pleasure, she modeled my clothes on the runways, and it just was kind of a really sweet situation. We also had an incredible producer named Elisa Bellatini, who was just bonkers and brilliant at exactly the same moment, and in the same doses, by the way. And she, like the rest of us, thought that style had nothing to do with money and only had to do with ingenuity. So with that as a framework, we could really just celebrate in the most beautiful ways. And the saddest part to me is that is not around, nor has it been since House of Style stopped. There's been no approach to design like that. And it just seemed to me the most obvious thing. So I'm actually a little shocked that...
It really has. I'll have to be honest, Amy and I, who work together at Design Sponge, have toyed around for years now of how could we find a way to bring House of Style back.
You could
do
it.
It's just the most perfect platform, I think, for combining music and actors and, you know, design. I'll never forget you interviewing Debbie Mazur on a couch, and I think you had green hair.
I did
at that point.
Hair.
It was very 90s, but it was such an excellent way to sort of combine all those worlds and show how, like you mentioned earlier, the common denominator was just talent, and it didn't really matter what particular skill they had. They were interesting, and you were exposing them to an audience that never would have been exposed to that before.
Absolutely, and we got to do so many things first. Like that interview that you just heard a piece of was with the designer, brilliant designer Andre Walker, who I've been such a fan of, but you can tell just in those four sentences the man is not normal, and that sort of passion was just really, really thrilling to me. Look at the way he described it, for the corny girl, for the stale girl. I mean, we were both laughing hysterically during it, and it's still just as riveting to me hearing it today as I did when I heard it almost 20 years ago at this point. But right after that, we spoke to John Galliano, and it was his very first collection being shown in Paris, and to be able to sit with somebody and talk about fabric being cut on the bias, which is the cross grain, really way too much technical talk, but to me the whole reason John's clothes moved like they did. So it was pretty amazing what we got away with on that, frankly. Truly the parents weren't home. I just turned my pieces in finished. They said, you got 3 minutes and 50 seconds, what are you doing? And then here's the tape, and on air it went.
I wish there was more of that. I mean, do you watch TV anymore? Is there anything on TV that you're finding inspiring in terms of art and design?
Oh, art and design? No. I really don't think so. I mean, there's TV I like, for sure. This seems like this season there's been some very interesting kind of mainstream TV that's popped up. Some highly subversive stuff that's masquerading as NBC fodder. So that surprised me. But as far as design goes, no.
What are you watching on NBC that's subversive?
Well, there was a show, something about the Don't Trust the Bitch and something.
Oh, an apartment something.
Which
yeah.
I was very leery of until I actually watched it. And I was shocked at how the writing is whip smart. Those characters are incredible actors. They're getting away with a lot. So I don't know what's happened, but it seems like the parents aren't home at NBC right now.
That would be nice. I feel like there's very little in the way of sort of, I think, inspiring, edgy, and sort of avant-garde content for younger people who are interested in creative pursuits of any type. I think
it
all
so
kind
true.
Of gets watered down, and like we were talking about before, it gets brought down to this idea of like how much money are you showing off in a project.
And it's true. And then we have weird ideas about the notions of designers, and unfortunately fashion design, where I started, is now the leaders are people like Kardashians and things that, I mean, whatever, God bless them, but I wouldn't say that they had the natural skills to make you look at a long career and that stuff. But you know, it's just a different time. We can't lament. We just have to keep moving forward. And for every crap show, there's, you know, Louis or some other kind of brilliant thing that makes us have hope in the world again.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things I loved is I really miss the Handmade Modern segments that you did with Amy Sedaris, where she would make projects. And I saw a clip on your blog the other day of Amy wearing a bracelet on the Today Show that I think you'd made from aluminum foil.
Yes, yeah, that's a great trick. Leftovers.
And I love that you've carried that through since the beginning, that no matter how successful you have gotten, you still go back to these sort of everyday materials. And I see that present in the kid collection that you're doing for Target now, which I think is fantastic. And I love that you've approached it from an angle of these essential craft goods. These are, you know, art materials children are going to be working with, can still be beautiful objects. And I remember
absolutely.
We got to see those crowns that have layers of color in them.
Yeah.
Could be used as a sculpture, let alone an actual functional object.
Absolutely. I just remember everything about the things, the toys or whatever I had as a kid, the way the instructions looked, the off register printing, it all was just so meaningful. So when we had the opportunity to do something for kids, we took it really, really seriously. And I'm not going to be the one that screws up a kid. That's not my job. There's plenty of other people signed up for that.
Well, I think you've done a great job. I read an interview a while back where I think New York Magazine called you the Pied Piper of crafts or something, which I can't imagine actually being more fitting and a more loving description, at least from the way I view it. I do really see you as constantly being the face of this movement of really bringing things back home, bringing things back to using your own two hands. And it really is a great equalizer. And I think it's a beautiful thing that you've brought to design.
Well, you're very sweet to say that. It's sad to me that people have associated style or interest or creativity with money. And it's just has nothing to do with it. So I'm happy to sort of reemphasize that.
Well, before we head out, I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the charity work that you've done. I think that's something that's incredibly important to be involved in every artist's life. I think sometimes you get so involved in producing your own work that you forget about being involved in other ways you can give back. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the charity projects you've been involved in and what they mean to you?
Well, I've just been probably one of the luckiest people I've ever met in my life, and I never forget that. And it just thrills me to be able to take the brightness of some things and sort of move the flashlight to someone else. And that part's really good. But what I found most fruitful is to find a way to build charitable situations into normal business, because charity fundraising today is very different than 10 years ago or 10 years prior to that, or even 10 years before that, which is way easier. It's a nightmare now, but it's understandable. Money's a lot tighter. People don't have the same kind of focuses. So when you can build charitable donations into normal situations, and that's a fantastic, fantastic way to go. But I just think it's part of the natural ebb and flow and grace of getting to do things. You know, you should just giving back is a very normal thing. Plus, I mean, I couldn't be any more blessed. I just get beautiful things thrown at me all the time, and I'm very, very happy about it. So if I can be any part of making that experience for others, it thrills me.
Well, you've done so much for so many of us. I know you've inspired me so much from a very young age, and very grateful that you were able to talk with us today. So,
well, you're inspiring to me too, and we have a few decades difference in our age, but you have the same sort of passion and the ability to get stuff done. And your last book, I mean, I know we're on air talking, but still, that book was brilliant, and it was such a beautiful survey, and was missing the bullshit and the ideas about what's important to others, and you just did your own point of view, and that's why it's so precise. So cheers. Oh, God,
thanks,
just like
Todd.
We'd be on radio kissing each other's ass. But anyway, I mean it.
Thanks, Todd. I really appreciate it. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all of you listening. You can listen to us live every Monday afternoon from 12 to 12:30 at heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks to Screaming Females for letting us use their music on the show today. And we will see you next Monday. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.